Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. I'm your host, Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, Marvin Gowen, and Pam Chapek. Hello, you guys.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Paula, Pam, Andre.
Yes.
Nice to be with you all.
Yeah.
Marvin,
Andre, Pam, and Paula. That would be great.
Yes. There you go.
I'm so glad. And we're starting a new paper. What's even better? Paper 3, The Attributes of God. You know, when I first saw that title of that paper, it just, you know, the titles of the first five papers were astonishing to me. But to think that God has attributes, you know, let's talk about God's attributes. Let us tell you about God's attributes. We know you knew God was great, but you didn't know how great God is. Allow us to tell you how great is God.
Really, let's describe the infinite for you. Yeah.
Just to me, it was such a thirst quencher. I can't even express how much it meant to me the first time I read this paper, all of these papers actually, but to realize, get a handle on these concepts that have been out there for so long. I mean, people say God is omnipresent. Okay. What does that mean, though? You know, and they really, God is perfect. Well, yeah, what does perfect mean now? And this is just amazing. So,
you know, it's also really, really interesting to look at the first five papers and just look at the progression of, you know, even the titles of the papers of those first five. And it gives us a sense of what they consider primary. You know, and even the sequence of what's primary. So they start off with the paper, The Universal Father, and then they talk about God's nature, which seems real close into the center, but they start off with the parental relationship. And then they talk about God's nature, and then now we're into the attributes, and then they're immediately into relationships with paper four, God's relation to the universe, and paper five, God's relation to the individual. And then they move on to the eternal Son. But those first five papers of, you know, the fatherly nature, the nature of God, the attributes and relationships, it's just an interesting sequence.
It is. To me. It really is. You know, and it's complete. I think, you know, everybody always says, you know, there's certain papers in the book that you could read all five and get such a complete concept of what it's talking about, the religion papers, the thought adjuster papers, clearly the God papers are like that. And, you know, and they spend five on the infinite spirit and the eternal Son as well. And that's even been called the new Pentateuch, which I find an interesting way to look at it, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's really fun to consider some of the organization of the papers in the Urantia book. And it is interesting, isn't it, that the first five mirror the idea of the first five books of the Bible, but to a much more interesting level, talking about the most important reality in the universe to begin with, and that is God the Father. And then the next five papers round out our relationship with the Trinity by first taking two papers on the Son, two papers on the Spirit, and then one paper that talks about the meaning of the whole and the relationship among all three divine, infinite persons of deity. And it's just very interesting how they've organized things. And you can find those kinds of different kinds of organizations throughout the Urantia book. There is a Pentateuch of the thought adjusters, the God within.
Right. Yeah.
There is a Pentateuch of the origin of life, papers 57 through 61, and the rise of will on our planet, of what makes an inhabited world. There's a Pentateuch of the supreme and experiential deity, with papers 115 through 119. And then very often people say, well, wait a minute, paper 119, that's seven bestowals of Christ Michael. And what don't you understand about that being a revelation of the Supreme?
Yes, right. Yeah. He was the first one to reach supremacy in this universe, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Well, as far as anybody can tell.
Right.
And hence, they say, being the one being in Nebadon to reach that estate, he qualifies to be sovereign of Nebadon.
And once again, becomes the ultimate wayshower for all of us.
Yeah.
As he always does, as he always will.
Mm-hmm.
And to think
he also did
that here on this world, merely something special for us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Marvin, sorry.
No. It's also really interesting to look at the first 10 papers as essentially the theology of the Urantia revelation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because then with paper 11 and 12, they're into the sort of the structure of things more.
The cosmology, more.
Yeah, the cosmology with the eternal isle and the universe of universes. But papers, 1 through 10 really deal with the persons of the Trinity and the nature of God and God's fundamental reality. So it's just, they're very systematic.
Yes, and yeah. Everything gets finally described further and further into the papers. You know, just like this is just sort of the clear overview that we begin with of all those details. And yet, as we go through the different pages, papers, it's almost like diving into part of the foreword where things, especially, I don't even have it in front of me, but just the details that are brought out in energy, mind, and spirit, and places like that. Whatever we're learning in the first five papers of the Father is further enlarged, as how it affects the universal. So it's just, this is the beginning. It is in the beginning basis for what's to come.
Mm. What a journey it is. I don't know if I'm hearing a bit of an echo, and I'm not sure why, but I just want to put it out there.
Well, I'm going to mute. Tell me if it goes away.
Okay. Let's see. I don't hear it now. Do you guys hear it?
Yeah, I don't hear it now.
Do you
either.
Hear it? Okay. No,
yeah,
okay.
It's probably feedback. It's probably a little bit of
feedback.
Area.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So Marvin, if you just jump back and forth if you want, I mean, you know.
Well, I'll change some settings too.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's funny how, when you hear an echo, it's hard to keep your train of thought. Have you ever noticed that? It's like, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why that's true, but it's just interesting. You almost instinctively want to listen to the echo, and then your train of thought gets derailed. It's pretty interesting. But
yeah.
Well, what can we say about the Urantia book? I hope, this is my profound hope, you guys. And I think about this a lot. Because here it is, it's a magnificent obsession in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done everything I can think of to share it with others. it just means so much to me. It has meant so much to me in my life. And the older I get, the more I think, wow, am I just an odd duck? what is with me? Why does this thing burn in me? And, to me, it's the best thing I've ever found. It's the best news I've ever found.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best thing. I hold it next to the birth of my children.
Mm-hmm.
There are two experiences in my life that have changed me forever for the better. One is finding the Urantia book and reading it, and the other is having children. And, and then we read it again, and I think the fervor, the magic never goes away for me. And I don't know, I guess the reason I'm going on like this is for all of the people who may listen to these recordings in the archive in the future, just know that, and I know this is true for all of you as well, we share this for our own mutual edification, that's true, but also because it means that much to us. And we hope that by doing so, it will help future people discover it as well and understand it and love it the way we do, because it's introduced us to a friendly and well-ordered universe, a divine and loving Father God, a beautiful Mother Spirit, the everywhere presence of God, you know, our Creator Son and our creative daughter, understanding our planet better, understanding ourselves better, understanding the purpose of Jesus' life and teachings better. It's just made all the difference in the world. And so that's why we share it. You know, we want it to help others too. You know, you can't, you know, when you find something that good, that makes that much of a difference for you. You're just compelled to share it. It's the best part of human nature, really. I mean, yeah, you know, there's the old saying, misery loves company, but joy also craves fellowship. And when you have an experience that changes your life for the better in every way, how can you not share that? You have to. We all do. We find a good book, we tell others about it. We see a great movie, we have to tell others about it. We have a great experience, we go on a great trip, we meet a great person, we hear a great speaker. We are inspired by something, we have to share it. And that's the best of us. So that's why we do it, friends. If you're listening now or in the future, it's because it means that much to us. And that's a beautiful thing to share with all of you, too. And when we go to conferences, and why when we go to a conference, it's like a little bit of light in life. Because now suddenly nobody thinks you're nutty. You know, right. Because you want to talk.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
I wouldn't go that far.
I wouldn't go that far. That's a bridge too far. There may be, indeed be some that think you're nutty, but it's in a good way.
You know, I just, I don't know, are you guys hearing the echo now, by the way? I'm making changes.
Okay,
better.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to pick up on your theme about the odd duck experience. That's really an interesting way to put it, Paula. And that I resonate with that. and what it made me think of is that this experience that we have here with the Urantia revelation, on some level, everyone that wakes up on the Mandarin Worlds will have that, something like that kind of experience. But it will be really a different phenomenon than what we experience. And I think our experience with the revelation, in a sense, is more extreme. And I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean it is a more intense version of being in touch with larger realities while still being contained in smaller realities. And I think it's very much an odd duck experience to, and I don't think it happens very often in the local universe or in the universes at all, to be in a state of such isolation and in such a difficult environment, and at the same time to have a window and to have access to this much, much larger picture like the material we're going to read about today. And it is a very unusual experience. And I think not that many people get to have that experience. And it is both, I think, a privilege and an incredible, I don't know how to say it, an incredible satisfaction to have that perspective while being in the midst of such a limited environment and with such a limited nature as we have in this initial life on this world. But it's not only a privilege, it has its set of difficulties, you know, and frustrations, you know, and the odd duck quality of it, I think, is part and parcel of it. And, you know, I think maybe, well, Zagadonter, you know.
It's an odd duck planet. Let's face it, we're all having an odd duck experience to one degree or another.
Well, it's true. It is an all-dark planet, and everyone on this planet is having that experience, but it's additionally unusual to be having that experience while exposed to the perspectives of this remarkable fifth epical revelation. And that's an even much, much more unusual experience, I think. And I think it precipitates out meanings and values in the Supreme that really are rather unusual. I think they happen in other parts of the universes, wherever there's rebellion and isolation. But I'm curious, and I will be curious to ask our wonderful higher up celestial sisters and brothers, how often has it been that a written in-depth, you know, in-depth revelation has been given to a world like this one, with so much contrast between good and evil and confusion and clarity and, you know, vision and blindness? I wonder how often that's happened in the universes. I would think not that often. It's such an unusual set of circumstances.
Yeah, I agree.
I know. True.
And to have a major detailed revelation like this, living on a world where the previous revelation was the bestowal of the Creator Son of the local universe.
Right.
That would make it a one-off, I think.
Those two things. It makes it intensely odd duck.
Yeah, intensely. And I always find comfort in knowing Jesus probably felt like the oddest of odd ducks on this planet, you know, and so did Adam and Eve, and so did probably any being that has come here from somewhere where things are divinely ordered, what we would consider perfect, to come here and try to take in all that's going on this sphere.
Well, they make this really interesting statement. Yeah, they say that Jesus was the most misunderstood person. I can't remember the exact specifics, but it's sort of tantamount to whoever lived. No one was ever more misunderstood. And I think it's because of the circumstances, and I think we share in some of that experience.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, Pam was going to say something. What were you going to say, Pam?
Oh, I'm sorry. I lost it now at this point. But
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. One of the things that I struggle with, though, is how resistant people that truly love God can be to wanting to embrace a greater experience, revelation of God.
Ooh, yeah.
Their feet are in the mire of having to depend solely on the Bible, and to make that leap is just asks too much for them, either theologically or, you know, because they're pastors or whatever. And when I hear you talk, Polly, you speak about how wonderful the book is and how it affects your life and how all those beautiful details you mentioned. It's like, I just feel like I would be the odd duck if I started talking that way amongst, you know, my emergent progressive Christians.
Yes,
I mean,
I get it.
You know, it's frustrating, and I feel like all I can do is throw out a sentence here or a concept there. And so I don't know. I'm not quite sure. Maybe I just need to start writing. I need to have my own personal revelation that can be read by people, I guess, if they're interested. I don't know what
it is. And
I'm stuck.
I have nothing but admiration for people, and I know you know who I might be talking about. who could read this book and understand Christianity so well as to take its concepts and couch them in a Christian language that is not so odd to Christians, mm-hmm. and actually excite them and thrill them and make them go, wow, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not threatening, maybe because of who it's coming from, maybe, but I think in large part it's because of the way they understand these authors who have a foot in both camps, and I think they are secretly in one, right, but yeah. openly in the other. Yet they're very adept. They understand their tribe so well, or they understand Christianity so well that they can take the concepts of the Urantia book and restate them in such a way that Christians get it, mm-hmm. and they don't feel mm-hmm. threatened by it.
Right.
And I think that is the preparation of the soil for a future time when mm-hmm. over time, there will be more of an openness to it. Then it's like a, you know, a willingness. There's so much fear on this world, and it's we've misunderstood. I mean, it's why the book is here, right? We've so misunderstood God that, and we're so convinced that God is just the big bookkeeper in the sky who's kicking off all of our aggressions and looking for just the right reason to keep us out.
Right.
I mean, for us, it's ridiculous when you start to think about it, because we know God so well now, it's absurd. And we get it when the book says those ideas are repugnant.
Mm-hmm.
But certain religionists on this planet are still deeply entrenched in that fear that God mm-hmm. isn't going to let them go on in the great game of life. They're not going to have eternal life. I mean, to take that away from somebody, it's to wow. hold that over their head, you know, and it's not enough to say you won't get eternal life. You'll get eternal damnation.
Yeah, right.
You'll get, you yeah. know. That it's so fear-based, and we're so susceptible to that, and have been for so long. It's kind of baked in our cake down here, and so mm-hmm. this thing is a long-haul kind of a task, and I think it takes all of the above. It takes the people with a foot in both camps. It takes the people like you who are willing to throw out a tidbit here and there. It takes people like me who's willing to stand at a booth and say straight up, this is what mm-hmm. I think it is. You know, decide for yourself. It takes all of the above. And for who knows how long before people will start to open to the idea that maybe we do live in a friendly and well-ordered universe, and maybe God isn't the great judge in the sky, mm-hmm. but the great Father in our hearts. Anyway, I do go
yeah.
on.
No, that's what we're here to do, is
right?
To find that bridge to, you know, sweeten the pie or whatever, sweeten the experience.
You know, I think there's a parallel to I've been in a study group, just been reading the sections toward the end of Jesus' life. There's a real parallel to how the apostles, no matter how many times he told them and how many different ways Jesus tried to show them a larger perspective, they kept holding on to their messianic expectations
yeah.
and
yeah.
their points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost
mm-hmm.
like it had to be torn away from them before they would consider something different and something new. And I think it's in human nature. They say that, you know, it's our preconceptions that keep us captive. And
spiritually captive.
You know, I think many people who find the Urantia book and embrace it have already had those preconceptions, whether they're Christian or other preconceptions, torn away or felt mm-hmm. inadequate. deeply inadequate, and so we're in a sense more free of those preconceptions and more out at sea and wandering and questing for something new and much different. I think it's the folks who really stay strongly rooted in their tradition that in some sense have a more challenging time to accept the new truth. And I just think it's a phenomenon in nature in general. And you know, I mean, what I take great comfort in is, I mean, I know they're all very sincere truth seekers, have not a shred of a doubt. I don't know. I wonder about people who hold their points of view in order to exclude others and for whom it's, you know, sort of almost it can serve as an excuse for hate and other non-spiritual motivations. But take the whole spectrum, people. What I take great comfort in is that Awakening on the Mansion Walls will be exactly the shock and rearrangement that will allow them to really see new truth. So the limitations are very temporary.
And yes, you're right, Marvin.
Yeah. Blink of an eye.
And if you know, so many of us, and I guess I've been so blessed to have been at the end of a number where your Rancho Book Readers called just to talk so much. And I've talked to so many people in the movement, and I've met so many people who have been challenged with the odd duck syndrome, you know, in terms of their whole life, you know, their families, their friends, their social communities, you know, if they came out and stated how much they believe it, they risk a lot. They've lost a lot. I know people who have lost their children over it. You know, they literally divorce and you know, you cannot see your children, you're in a strange cult. You know, have lived with that reality, have just, you know, can't give up the Rancher book, can't give up what the truth they've found, this beautiful thing they've found, but the other side of it is, sorry, then you can't see your children, you know? People have paid terrible, terrible prices for believing in this thing. It's not like being fed to the lions, for sure, but...
Yeah,
I've known many who have paid a dear, dear price for having found this great revelation and loved it. And it's just an interesting place to be in the history of this world. And I know we all have faith that someday this marvelous jewel will be seen for what it is, you know. The stars are best discerned, you know. It's a star. And, you know, I should say... Andre, put your quote up on the board, Marvin. Andre, you want to read that? It's the one about Jesus being misunderstood.
Yeah, sure. It is forever true. This is 154.69 for those paying attention to citations. Arvilla was the one who got us, always made us, get onto the citations. Yeah. Now she doesn't need them. Now she can remember it all. Probably it's all in her mind.
Now she's on the Mansion World. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is forever true that all who may think they are misunderstood or not appreciated have in Jesus a sympathizing friend and an understanding counselor. He had warned his apostles that a man's foes may be they of his own household. But he had hardly realized how near this prediction would come to apply to his own experience. And, they don't necessarily say that he was the most misunderstood, but clearly from the standpoint of what can you really understand about who the master was, can anybody completely fathom what it means to be a creator son living in human form? I don't think so.
No, would not be possible. The Supreme can.
Yes.
Supreme
can, and a being this being who is the sun, who is embodying all the beautiful nature and attributes of the infinite God as one human being, you know, doing the best to portray that. Talk about a lens, you know, it's,
talk about a lens.
He who has seen me has seen the Father, and it's like, that's a job.
Yeah.
It was, and that's what's so beautiful about this Urantia version of the Jesus story, is that we really get to see who God is, unlike we do through the Bible. And it's just so enriching, and it's something we can take into our personal lives a lot more easily because it's so much more specific.
Right. Yeah, you can call upon it.
One of the things when we were talking about the duck, the odd duck, I do want to say that the series The Chosen has really nailed that. And it's because they use the phrase, get used to different. And because what happened is Simon Peter had been saved miraculously by Jesus. And as they were going through town, they showed Jesus looking at Matthew in the booth where Matthew's taking all the taxes. And, of course, tax collectors are abhorrent to Jews. So Jesus had stopped, and he turns to Matthew and he says, you know, follow me. And the look on Matthew's face was so sweet, so beautiful, because he was already kind of intrigued. But so, and then Simon Peter says, now, wait a minute. Now, wait a minute. Not him. And so Jesus.
Not him.
And then basically what he says is, Simon was saying that his own experience, well, that was different. And Jesus says, get used to different. You know, Matthew's joining me. Get used to different. And so they've got a T-shirt now, you know, that says, get used to different.
I like that.
Yes, in fact, I wore it on my trip that I just got back from. I just love it because it applies to so much that's going on our planet right now. You know, somebody that reads that, it affects individuals in different ways. And yet it's true. Get used to different, because it's only going to become more diverse, more different, more confusing. So get used to it. So, so that's
get
part
used
of being
to change.
So that's part of being an odd duck, is displaying the difference, you know, what is different. So,
beautiful. I'm going to get one of those T-shirts. That's pretty awesome. Yeah. But I want to read what Bob said on the board, and then we can start with paper 3, the attributes of God, because this is so beautiful. You guys can see it, Andre, and I don't know if you, Marvin, you can't, but for those who will listen on the archive and for our listeners right now, Bob said, in the first 100 years of the Urantia Revelation, the vast majority of people on this planet will live and die without ever having any knowledge or exposure to these amazingly beautiful, enlightening, informative, inspiring, and truthful papers. Just like when Jesus walked on earth, the vast majority of people never heard him speak. And just as blessed and fortunate as those who got to hear the Master speak 2,000 years ago, we readers of the Urantia book are likewise fortunate and blessed. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah,
that's so beautiful.
Nice.
I love it. Oh, and with that, let's just be blessed and read. the attributes of God. Yeah. Who would like to start with the preamble of this paper?
Happy to read it.
Okay.
Let's jump in. The attributes of God. God is everywhere present. The universal Father rules the circle of eternity. But he rules in the local universes in the persons of his paradise creator sons, even as he bestows life through these sons. God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his sons. These creator sons of God are the personal expression of himself in the sectors of time and to the children of the whirling planets of the evolving universes of space. The highly personalized sons of God are clearly discernible by the lower orders of created intelligences. And so do they compensate for the invisibility of the infinite and therefore less discernible Father. The Paradise Creator Sons of the Universal Father are a revelation of an otherwise invisible being, invisible because of the absoluteness and infinity inherent in the circle of eternity and in the personalities of the Paradise deities. Creatorship is hardly an attribute of God. It is rather the aggregate of his acting nature. And this universal function of creatorship is eternally manifested as it is conditioned and controlled by all the coordinated attributes of the infinite and divine reality of the first source and center. We sincerely doubt whether any one characteristic of the divine nature can be regarded as being antecedent to the others. But if such were the case, then the creatorship nature of deity would take precedence over all other natures, activities, and attributes. And the creatorship of deity culminates in the universal truth of the fatherhood of God.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, do we want to discuss that, or do we want to keep going and read section one?
I think there's enough there to discuss it. But go ahead.
No, do you? It gives me a feeling, you know? It just gives me a feeling. That's almost it's a feeling without a word, I guess. And there's an understanding that goes so deep that how can we see something that inhabits the circle of eternity? I get that. And so we have these, you know, creator sons who become the focal point for us, as Pam was saying, who become the lens and let us see something that, and as you were reading it, Andre, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you can't see the circle as someone inhabiting the circle of eternity, something that's everywhere present, but there's a focal point at the center of all things, all that is. Wow, how intense is that? No wonder you have to go through all of those, all of that ascension to get to that place to
be
able
to
stand in the presence. Major
hurdles.
But it's going to be worth it, right? But in the meantime, you get these little, you know, the lesser things that keep you going. And certainly I don't mean to minimize the impact of our precious Christ Michael, because he's no less, you know, he's not lesser, but at least we can see him. He's a focal point of this greater deity.
Isn't it interesting how they
a meaning without a word.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting how they? I mean, these are three simple paragraphs, but you know, just looking at
what they do in these three paragraphs. The very first thing they do is talk about, you know, God being everywhere. And then the very next thing they say in the next sentence, but he rules in the local universes in the persons of his creator sons, right? Even as he bestows life through these sons. The very first thing the revelators want to do, this divine counselor in this case, wanting to let us know that we have a touchstone. We have a touchstone in the paradise creator sons. And that's the very first thing they want to do is to, again, talk about God is not far off, and then God is approachable. And that's the very first thing that we're being told really here. It's how approachable God is. And then, you know, they go into that a little bit further. The highly personalized sons of God are clearly discernible by the lower orders of created intelligences. And so do they compensate for the invisibility. Now, wait a minute here. We're able to see on that level. They're not talking about human sight. They're talking about celestial vision, even spiritual vision, even if of the lower spiritual orders. But even the high spiritual beings of Nevadon, many of them, cannot see the Father directly, at least not until, you know, they get to Avona or whatever else. I mean, many do. Many have come from there. A few have. But just consider that. Consider how many beings there are in Nebadon who, like us, have never seen the Father or the Eternal Son or the Infinite Spirit. They've never been there. And so there's the whole sojourn and ascension through the local universe is a faith experience where we are trusting that those who are representing the Father, like our Creator Son, is actually telling the truth and showing the truth and illustrating the truth, that there is, in fact, at the center of all things, not only the most powerful being in the world, which is really what humanity is focused on. You dare not, you know, get bad daddy angry, you know, is most of what the religions of the world have taught us.
You dare not.
Instead, they're trying to get us, on most of the other worlds they understand this, but on our world, they're trying to get us to the point once again of really and truly understanding that this is not bad daddy. And this is not a king judge. This is your daddy, our Father, who is there. And despite the fact that you can't see him, he's there and even approaches you directly through your indwelling, which they get into later, right? And in many other places, the fact that we're actually indwelled. But the third paragraph, and I'll be quiet after this, is very interesting, isn't it? Because they talk about creatorship as being this thing that establishes the fatherhood of God, and yet they try to give us a sense and get us to question this a little bit, that creatorship is not really an attribute of God like okay, I'm envisioning Mickey Mouse in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, right? He's not that.
That's a good one.
Yes. He doesn't have a wand in his hand, and he's got creatorship that way. No. The aggregate of his acting nature, which now gives us a different way to think about it. It's less magic, less way above and superhuman, and more a matter of, somehow it's an aspect of the fact that he also is the most loving and first source personality in creation. So that really raises a lot more questions than answers. And we could ask that question here. What does that mean? What does that really mean that it is rather the aggregate of his acting nature? Really wonderful for the divine counselor to give us that.
I agree, because it struck me the same way. You know, what do they mean by that? It's the aggregate of his acting nature. It's almost like it's so outgoing. It is so who he is. He couldn't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just is pouring out.
Mm-hmm.
This amazing creative energy.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that the Paradise Creator Sons are called Paradise Creator Sons. So that whole creatorship is linked in there.
Yes.
I was really struck by that as well, Pam. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I've really made that connection.
Yeah, me too.
Is that they, you know, the Father gives issuance to all things and all beings, in a sense, and the Creator Sons and the create, and it's also interesting that they call the Mother Spirit the Creative Spirit. So you know, both of those are mm-hmm. participating in the creation, but in different ways.
Right.
The Creator and the Creative, and so it's really interesting that the Creator Sons really share that quality with the Universal Father.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it a prerogative, which is interesting. Later, they call it a prerogative, the creative prerogative.
That's right. And we are creatures. We are creatures.
Good point.
And yet we're also creators also. So that's to be discussed later.
Because of will. We are. It's true.
Yeah.
Because of will, we are.
Mm-hmm.
I like that, Pam. Mm-hmm. That's the same suffix as furniture. Yeah.
Sure. It sure is.
Well, and then in the end of that paragraph, they say, and this is intriguing as well, equally, we sincerely doubt whether any one characteristic of the divine nature can be regarded as being antecedent to the others. But if such were the case, then the creatorship nature of deity would take precedence over all other natures, activities, and attributes. Wow.
Yeah.
He's got our attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
This divine counselor.
Well, you know, it makes me think of the sections where they talk about this, the quote, the sequence of functions that occurred at the beginning of everything, where there was the I Am, who was God before God was a creator. And mm-hmm. the very first and initial function was the creation of the Son, and they together the creation of the infinite spirit in paradise. And it's just like, yeah, you begin to see it, that creating was the initial and primary function of the deity before the deity acted and then first acted. It was a creative act. And in a certain way, we share in that function, in the creation of the Supreme, and in partnership mm-hmm. with our thought adjusters, where, you know, we go into creative partnership with the adjuster to create unique realities that only happen in each of our lives. So, I mean, there's that creative function and creator function. Just there's a carry through all the way down. I'm right with you, Pam. You know, that makes us creatures. I don't think it's incidental in our language that they all share that root.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to share what Perry said on the board because it's such a great visual for me, Perry. Thank you. She said, the image of a quiescent lake held by a dam, the creator's sons, the giant turbines. That's a good one. Wow.
Oh, wow.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Pouring that out, you know, just pouring out that energy and that beauty. And isn't there there's a quote, Andre, and I bet you know where it is, that kind of describes in the infinite past what happened with the I Am and the creation
of
the second source and center. Can you find that one? Because what Marvin just said.
Are you talking about their effort to time space, the whole outworking of deity, something that happened really in eternity?
Right, and they say, of course, you know, it didn't, you know, your mind wants to give it an origin point, but it really doesn't have, but to relieve the tension of infinity or something like that, it was the original relationship, the original relationship, the original other.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember where that is? Is that in the foreword?
Oh, I'll find it here in a moment. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's such an amazing statement. And, you know, if they even though it's not possible to describe these in the human language, in the English language, they still attempt it, you know, with great success, in my opinion. I mean, it's amazing how well they express these concepts.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's in the foreword. It's in section 3, paragraph 20. And I'm not sure, they at least make the beginning in talking about that, where they say, nevertheless, there are antecedent and eternal realities, superfinite realities, which are ancestral to this supreme deity of evolutionary time-space creatures. In attempting to portray the origin and nature of universal reality, we are forced to employ the technique of time-space reasoning in order to reach the level of the finite mind. Therefore, must many of the simultaneous events of eternity be portrayed as sequential transactions. And then they go on from there. They give the basis for how the I Am would have self-differentiated. And then in 22,
right.
In this original transaction, the theoretical I Am achieved the realization of personality by becoming the eternal father of the original son, simultaneously with becoming the eternal source of the Isle of Paradise. Coexistent with the differentiation of the Son from the Father, and in the presence of Paradise, there appeared the person of the Infinite Spirit and the central universe of Havona. With the appearance of coexistent personal deity, the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit, the Father escaped as a personality from otherwise inevitable diffusion throughout the potential of total deity, and on and on. Is that what you were looking for?
Yeah, that was it. Yep.
Okay.
Such a transaction to try to describe.
Yeah. Thank you, Andre.
But so much more, don't you find it much more satisfying than just the Big Bang?
Well, for one thing, the Big Bang compared to this is a little firecracker. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean,
I'm being, you know.
This is all of infinity. This is all of infinity differentiating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Bang is just 13.8 billion light years wide or more, maybe radius.
Yeah. And it happened in time.
It happened in time, yeah.
Yeah.
Not in eternity. But it didn't happen, is the point. that the revelators would make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Marvin, for jogging that in my memory, that great description of those eternal transactions. fills you with wonder.
Yeah, it does. There are probably some other passages, and I don't know quite where to find them. It'll probably take a while. But there is this quality, you know, and the visual is the I am sitting there all by itself before ever there was a creative act. And it is just, I think it's really profound that the initial creative act is to create a child, you know, and to have that parent-child relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that parent-child relationship is the fundamental first creative unfolding of what was only potential in the I am into an actual.
Mm.
It's really it's a profound situation. and I think it really relates to why in those first 10 papers, the last two of those papers are about relationship. You know, God's relationship to the universe and God's relationship to the individual is because the creator nature makes relationship absolutely fundamental. The I am existed before there was any relationship because there was only one being. And so anyways, it's just that all, if on a feeling level, it makes really deep sense that God's creator nature is so fundamental to everything that's going on in reality.
And that the relationship.
Relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
To me, all the fruits of the Spirit are about that, right? They're about relationship. Mm. That's what they're all about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We're all in that relationship. We're in it. And we have to get it, make the most of it. That's what it's all about, how we relate to each other, and that's love, you know?
Well, and that's why, you know, I keep coming back to this. When they search for a metaphor or a symbolism with which to convey the nature of spiritual reality and the reality of what's going on in creation, they bring us to the family metaphor. You know, that it's all about relationships, and it's our relationships to our creator parents, and our relationships to each other. And that's the grand metaphor for what's going on in the cosmos. And you know, they allude to it in the nature and cultism as the higher symbolism of a higher civilization.
Right.
That's a powerful
thing. And truly it is.
Yeah.
And it is.
Yeah.
It's the highest.
Yeah.
When they say things like the family is our greatest purely human achievement, you know, it is. There's nothing more fundamental than those relationships.
Yeah. Well, and when you reflect on the fact that the I am's first creative acts were to become the parent of a child and then for the two of them to become co-parents of another child and to create the fraternal relationships as well. It's all there the vectors of relationship between the three persons of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all about family. It's a divine family, divine and original family. And out of that model, the rest of the creation proceeds. So it's profound and on very, very deep levels.
Yeah, the creatorship of deity culminates in the universal truth of the fatherhood of God. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know.
Well, with that in mind, let's read God's Every Awareness.
Right.
You know, it's just leave it to the Arranger book to come up with a word like every awareness.
Yeah.
I love it. It's going to confound spell checkers for a while. Yeah.
Sure.
It becomes
but
a part
you're,
of
you. You're right in pointing that out on the front end. It's so important. It's really trying to even make God's ubiquity and omnipresence approachable by taking it and putting it in the vernacular of a word like everywhereness.
Yeah, one word. One word.
Yeah. It could have said omnipresence, but it wouldn't have been the same, right? No, it's his everywhereness. I love it. Well, who wants to read this section? It's a long one. We could split it up or... Let's see, it's 12 paragraphs
long.
Yeah.
Okay. I can. Oh. Go ahead.
You start, Pam, and then you pick up,
okay.
Marvin.
Okay. I just want to make a very brief preliminary comment, and that is, as we read it, I think it's good to keep in mind that everywhereness means that God is here right now with us as we read and as we share. And to feel that presence within us and the Master Spirit, of just every way that deity manifests, that's a present pulsing reality.
To share
the experience with us. Sorry, go ahead.
Thanks for reminding us, because that's good. I love that. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Let's keep that in mind. He's with us now, always.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, God's everywhereness. The ability of the Universal Father to be everywhere present and at the same time constitutes his omnipresence. God alone can be in two places, in numberless places, at the same time. God is simultaneously present in heaven above and on earth beneath, as the psalmist exclaimed, whither shall I go from your spirit, or whither shall I flee from your presence? I am a God at hand as well as afar off, says the Lord. Do not I fill heaven and earth? The Universal Father is all the time present in all parts and in all hearts of his far-flung creation. He is the fullness of him who fills all and in all, and who works all in all. And further, the concept of his personality is such that the heaven universe and heaven of heavens, universe of universes, cannot contain him. It is literally true that God is all and in all, but even that is not all of God. I love that.
Pure poetry, really.
Yes. He's more than all in all. The infinite can finally be revealed only in infinity. The cause can never be fully comprehended by an analysis of effects. The living God is immeasurably greater than the sum total of creation that has come into being as a result of the creative acts of his unfettered free will. God is revealed throughout the cosmos, but the cosmos can never contain or encompass the entirety of the infinity of God. The Father's presence unceasingly patrols the master universe. His going forth is from the end of the heaven and his circuit to the ends of it. And there is nothing hidden from the light thereof. The creature not only exists in God, but God also lives in the creature. We know we dwell in him because he lives in us. He has given us his spirit. This gift from the Paradise Father is man's inseparable companion. He is the ever-present and all-pervading God. The spirit of the everlasting Father is concealed in the mind of every mortal child. Man goes forth searching for a friend, while that very friend lives within his own heart. The true God is not afar off. He is part of us. His spirit speaks from within us. The Father lives in the child. God is always with us. He is the guiding spirit of eternal destiny. Truly of the human race has it been said, you are of God, because he who dwells in love dwells in God and God in him. Even in wrongdoing, you torment the indwelling gift of God, for the thought adjuster must needs go through the consequences of evil thinking with the human mind of its incarceration. The omnipresence of God is in reality a part of his infinite nature. Space constitutes no barrier to deity. God is in perfection and without limitation, discernibly present only on paradise and in the central universe. He is not thus observably present in the creation encircling Havona, for God has limited his direct and actual presence in recognition of the sovereignty and the divine prerogatives of the coordinate creators and rulers of the universes of time and space. Hence must the concept of the divine presence allow for a wide range of both mode and channel of manifestation, embracing the presence circuits of the eternal Son, the infinite Spirit, and the Isle of Paradise. Nor is it always possible to distinguish between the presence of the Universal Father and the actions of his eternal coordinates and agencies. So perfectly do they fulfill all the infinite requirements of his unchanging purpose. But not so with the personality circuit and the adjusters. Here God acts uniquely, directly, and exclusively. Okay, I can stop there.
Do we want to discuss
Yeah. Do we want to take? Do we want to take a couple of years to discuss this?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That last statement really intrigued me. Of paragraph six. It's that nor is it always possible to distinguish between the presence of the Universal Father and the actions of his eternal coordinates and agencies. So perfectly do they fulfill all the infinite requirements of his unchanging purpose. But not so with the personality circuit and the adjusters. Here God acts uniquely, directly, and exclusively. Huh.
Yeah.
What are they meaning by that? Not so with the, I mean, is it because the adjusters indwell imperfect beings? So,
well, you know, what they're partly trying to do is, in that first part, indicate, you know, first of all, how good God's creatorship is, that he can actually create beings that function in complete harmony with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's God, the great delegator. So they make that great point, and they say with regard to practically everything, he delegates. But not so with personality and with the adjusters. He reserves to himself, you know, the right to have personal contact with all of his creature creation. And even so, even more so with the ascendant creation through the thought adjusters, two ways to be in touch.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, you know, what I take from that, those two sentences, And I think they're speaking, the beings, the celestial beings, are speaking from their perspective, that from their perspective, they can't always distinguish between the presence of the Father and the actions, his actions and the actions of his coordinates and agencies. So they can't always distinguish or get a sense of the difference of function. But they can distinguish that it's the Father alone that acts in the process of the adjusters, whether they hear God acts uniquely, directly, and exclusively. They can discern. Yeah, they can discern.
They can discern it.
Is,
okay.
This is the
they
soul
can distinguish
function. Yeah.
Huh. So it makes it more visible to them. That's it. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one. That's good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes more apparent.
You know, there's so much here. I have a general reaction, which is I feel like they're giving us material. I don't quite know how to express this. It feels like the degree to which I can penetrate this information that they're sharing with us, it feels so inadequate to what it is they're sharing. And I feel like we can make just the bare beginnings of, you know, an attempt to penetrate some of this. And I have this, and for me, it's a faith. It's really a faith attitude that I will, you know, in the rest of eternity, I and we will have the opportunity to really unpack what they're just foreshadowing or introducing to us in these sections on the nature of God, that we're just being given an exposure to it. And of course it feels over my head, so much of it. And if I can penetrate just a little bit of it, that's to the good, because this is stuff that we will get to work on forever. And part really is I will need forever to get beyond the surface of what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yet, these first six paragraphs of this section are loaded with quotes.
Yes.
From other scriptures. And, you know, they're bringing it home, right? Once again, I love to, when they do this, I think, okay, they're telling us, this is what you already know.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you've figured out. Let us synthesize it for you and pull it together for you in such a way that it'll really start to gel and make more sense to you.
Yeah.
And then they add a little creative license. Go ahead, Andre.
No, I don't want, I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, do it.
But
go ahead.
I'm in agreement with Marvin that this is, you know, so there's so much. This is like the iceberg, right? You know, what we can see is just such a tiny, tiny piece of what they're really trying to convey, what they wish they could convey to us. And yet, on the other hand, your point is well taken, that we have gotten to pieces of this in the past, which is why they are relating us, you know, to what they had gotten, you know, to us in the past. And all of that's important. Further, they want us to, they're not telling us for nothing. They're not telling us to show us how little we know, although that's probably part of what they're trying to tell us. The more important thing is to tell us that God is knowable and that eventually we will see God, even if we can't fully fathom or fully understand the infinity. At some point, we will personally recognize God, and that's going to be a big enough job all on its own. But this is all part of getting us there.
Yeah.
Everything is connected, isn't it? This idea of, first of all, trying to better the understanding of all human beings here on Earth. But is that their only purpose? No. Their purpose is to give you and I a head start for anybody that is looking for this stuff, they're saying, this is what you're ready for. So this is what we're giving you. And this is the flower pot from which you're growing. This is just the beginning. And that's put very well, Marvin. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome, Andre. What did I just say?
What did I just say? Yeah.
What he said.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to point out, too, that here's some of the artfulness of it, which I think probably from the very first time I read this, I went, oh, yeah. When he says, and he's quoting here, quote, I am the God at hand as well as afar off, says the Lord. Do not I fill heaven and earth? The universal Father is all the time present in all parts and in all hearts of his far-flung creation. He is the fullness of him who fills all and in all, and who works all and all. And further, the concept of his personality is such that the heaven, and then parenthetically, universe, and the heaven of heavens, parenthetically, universe of universes, cannot contain him. That is just like, that is an aha moment when you see that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is what they're saying. Let us redefine heaven, universe, and heaven of heavens, universe of universes. Good. Let us do that for you. Now you have a bigger concept, a concept that is congruent with science, with what you're about to discover in your world. And to me, that just... it all came together then. I know from the moment I read that, the first time I read that, I had an aha moment. Aha! This is what they're saying. This is what heaven means. It's a journey through the universe. It's not a place on a cloud. So it's just so, that's why I said it's pure poetry to me. You know, and then Pam, you made a comment, it is literally true that God is all and in all, but even that is not all of God. They make that point so amazingly.
Yes.
Go ahead, Paul.
Go ahead, Marvin. No. Go.
Well, I think the rest of the paragraph, then they take that last statement that the heaven of heaven is the universe of universes cannot contain him. And in the rest of that paragraph, they use their own words to try to convey this situation that we're in. When they say, it is literally true that God is all and in all, but even that is not all of God. So go figure out how to get your arms around that, right?
And right.
They go on to say, the infinite can be finally revealed only in infinity. Which means to me that it can't be finally revealed, because infinity means something that doesn't stop. So it's like a puzzle box, you know. The cause can never be fully comprehended by an analysis of the effects. And I think stuck with the effects, you know, how we come at it by an analysis of the effects, and we can't understand the cause by looking at our results. So I'm just trying to kind of penetrate a little bit into what they're saying here. And then they say the living God is immeasurably greater than the sum total of creation that has come into being as a result of the creative acts of his unfettered free will. God is revealed throughout the cosmos, but the cosmos can never contain or encompass the entirety of the infinity of God. And so, you know, somehow they're trying to get us to accept this premise that this revelation process, this discovery process, never really will come to an end.
It unfolds. It's unfolding and unfolding.
And it keeps going. Yeah. And so how could it come to an end?
It does. It really makes the whole Big Bang idea seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, because it always, you always get back to, well, what started the Big Bang? You know,
who
nobody wants to go there.
Well, yeah. I think you're
I like
you're
it.
Totally right. Totally right on, Pam, because the Big Bang, when they use that phrase, cannot be fully comprehended by an analysis of effects. I think that's exactly
yeah.
what science is trying to do, is to analyze
yep.
the effects, the end results, and say, well, how can we work backwards to come to an understanding of what really happened here? And that
mm-hmm.
you're never going to get there that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get this image of, well, let's call out your best fireman, and they're looking at the aftermath, right? And they're going to determine the cause of the fire.
That's
all of creation, right? We've called in our best investigators, and they've come to the conclusion that, yes, it was all a Big Bang. That is funny.
There's a fire that took place here.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's go have a beer.
Yeah. So let's go have a beer. Let's scratch our head and go have a beer. That's typical human. And you know, I have to point out that some of these quotes, like one of this one, touches me deeply. And I tried to search it online just as you were reading, Pam, and the first thing that came up is your Urantia Foundation. So, and I couldn't find the quote definitively online to try to find the source. But this one, man goes forth searching for a friend.
Mm.
While that very friend lives within his own heart.
Yeah.
Wow. That to me,
yeah.
that's just like one of those gems right there. You could put it.
Yes.
You could put it anywhere. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And people will resonate with it. I think. Going forth searching
yep.
for a friend, but while you're searching, remember that friend lives within your own heart. Wow.
Yeah.
And Gina posted something that Matthew had found in his source work. But I wonder, Gina, if you can look that quote up and see what the source of that one is, because I don't recall it being biblical, but it may be.
Which, the heaven of heavens?
No, man goes forth searching for a friend while that very friend lives within his own heart.
Well, you know, there's an interesting possibility, and this is sort of a bit of a tangent, but I think it's an interesting one. When you look at a passage that's in quotation marks like that one, man goes forth searching for a friend while that very friend lives within his own heart, it's possible that that quotation does not exist in our current literature. Because they have access to the original statement that was made when the human being who created it uttered it or wrote it. And it may have been lost or undergone transformation to the point where it's not really recognizable or barely so. And so, you know, they look at records in a very different way than we look at records, I imagine.
Good point. That's true. And Jesus, I know Jesus said something very similar, too. So they may
mm-hmm.
be quoting him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's what I was wondering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus in the Urantia book said it.
Yeah.
You know, he said it in another way, too, in Instruction for Teachers and Believers. He said, men search for God with weary hearts and aching feet or something, you know, all to find that very God lives within them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's some of those quotes are just priceless to me, you know, the ones in quotations.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, the true God is not far off. He is a part of us. His spirit speaks from within us. That's another one. It's just like, wow,
mm-hmm.
yes. The Father lives in the child. You know, that's something that if I could give Christianity just one gift, it would be that. If I could give humanity one gift, it would be God lives within you.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. God's in you.
you know, and it's not blasphemy to know that. You're not thinking right. You are God. If God is truly everywhere present, then how could he not be in you? And just that one revelation, I think, if fully embraced, could change the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if just the nature of how the Spirit of Truth works, the truth keeps on recirculating and finding very similar expressions in lots of different times in different people's lives. And there are these ahas that go on. Because I almost think like we need to have it repeated over and over and over again for it to penetrate our natures, you know.
Right.
So it's like the nature of truth is to reiterate itself in endless profusion down through the centuries in different people's expression, different people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, as any pedagogue knows, you have to say it and then say it again and tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them,
mm-hmm.
and then tell them what you told
what
them.
You told them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's us. I wanted to point out something else that's interesting. We often say they said, when we know this paper has one author, a divine counselor, and yet there's a bit of a, it's profound in a way because we seem to understand that this was a group effort and that more than one being participated in these teachings and these papers. They had a commission and they worked together on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably subject to edit and commentary and, you know, review, peer review, before it ended up in this book. So it's just something we often say, they said, and he mm-hmm. said, but they also said it. It's a group effort. I think that's beautiful to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your point is well taken. It's right at the end of part one in 31.10.22 where it talks about these 31 papers and, you know, the formulated, you know, about the grand universe, all of this stuff, were sponsored, formulated, and put into English by a high commission consisting of 24 Orvantan administrators acting in accordance with a mandate issued by the Ancients of Days of Yuversa, directing that we should do this on Urantia, 606 of Satania, in Norlaishadec of Nebadon in the year AD 1934. It is a group effort the whole time. 24
mm-hmm.
Orvantan
mm-hmm.
administrators. Nobody did this without running it by a commission.
So it is they, always. Even though this paper was authored by one. It is they.
Right. They're all authored.
You get the vision of like a grand review process. You know, everyone probably weighed in, but maybe this divine counselor had primary responsibility in partnership. But that's all conjecture. But, I mean, that would make sense given the description you just read, Andre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. Well, Marvin,
you know,
want to keep going? Go ahead, Andre, finish your thought. Sorry.
Well, I'll just say something that Halvorsen would always point out. You know, his thing was simply, can you imagine what a divine counselor, when they're authoring a paper, when they're putting something together, he's got in his mind right now all of the past literature and utterances of those on Urantia in order to formulate his statement. He can hold that all in his mind at one time. It probably doesn't take up all of his mind, far from it. And formulated that knowing everything that was ever said here on Urantia up to this point. And maybe even being able to anticipate some things that haven't yet been said.
Right. And to coordinate from his position of being in the presence of the Father. So his vast presence experience, you know, how to shine that light within the human element. And so that's why we're seeing a little bit of both in this. We're seeing the quotes from the past, but then we're getting the clarification of those quotes, like, God is all in all, but even that is not all of God.
Right.
It's like he's closer to infinity than we are, okay?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, not closer. He is. He is infinity.
Yeah, there you go. I know, it's hard to...
Hard to imagine what it is we don't know about God when everything that is part of God. Even if we talk about everything that we do know that he encompasses, what is it that we don't know that he also encompasses that we hasn't even dawned on us?
Yeah.
So much unrevealed.
And I think that's why I love the title of J.B. Phillips' book, Your God is Too Small, because it will always be true. Your God is too small. You've got a lot more to learn about your God.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that great?
Isn't
you
that
have a lot
great
to look
and wonderful?
To.
It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah. You have so much to look forward to.
Sort of a bit of a humbling experience.
A little bit of a humbling, yes.
You're here. Well, Marvin, you want to keep going with seven, and we'll.
Yeah, and well, why don't I take the next three paragraphs, Paula, and you can take the last three, so we each have a chance to read. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, that'd be great. And I just want to point out, Gina found that quote. Thank you, Gina. She said the phrase, go searching for a friend, but the friend is with me, is listed in Matthew's book as being sourced as a Hindu mantra. Slokas of religion.
Nice.
Isn't that great? So we can see, the reason I love that is because it's not just the Bible they're quoting here. And I think that's important to know.
Yeah.
So that's beautiful. Thank you, Gina.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, Marvin, let's do that. You take the first three and I'll take the last three. And we'll just push through and then we can discuss at the end.
Okay. And I'm just noticing that first paragraph from the paragraph seven begins the universal controller. And I think for continuity, I think they're speaking still of the Father. But that's an interesting question when they refer to the universal controller.
Oh, yeah, they definitely mean the Father,
yeah.
Okay.
So I'll go ahead, yeah. The universal controller is potentially present in the gravity circuits of the Isle of Paradise in all parts of the universe at all times and in the same degree in accordance with the mass in response to the physical demands for this presence. And because of the inherent nature of all creation, which causes all things to adhere and consist in him. So, yeah, let's spend 3-4 hours taking that sentence apart.
That was one sentence, by the way.
That was
one sentence.
Right. Likewise, is the first source and center potentially present. I'm sorry, I just got to draw this observation. They use phrases sometimes, and they're so complex that it's interesting to see a parallel. So the first sentence begins, universal controller is potentially present, and this sentence also begins with a term potentially present. So I'll just make that notation.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise is the first source and center potentially present in the unqualified absolute, the repository of the uncreated universes of the eternal future. God thus potentially pervades the physical universes of the past,
present, mm-hmm. and future. Primordial foundation of the coherence of the so-called material creation. This non-spiritual deity potential becomes actual here and there throughout the level of physical existences by the inexplicable intrusion of some one of his exclusive agencies upon the stage of universe action. The mind presence of God is correlated with the absolute mind of the conjoint actor. Okay, so I'm just made the observation that this paragraph, the first paragraph of Web, deals with more paradise and physical realities, and this one now they're talking about mind. The mind presence of God is correlated with the absolute mind of the conjoint actor, the infinite spirit. But in the finite creations, it is better discerned in the everywhere functioning of the cosmic mind of the paradise master spirits. Just as the first source and center is potentially present in the mind circuits of the conjoint actor, so is he potentially present in the tensions of the universal absolute. Mind of the human order is a bestowal of the daughters of the conjoint actor, the divine ministers of the evolving universes. The everywhere present spirit of the Universal Father is coordinated with the function of the universal spirit presence of the Eternal Son and the everlasting divine potential of the Deity Absolute. But neither the spiritual activity of the Eternal Son and his paradise sons, nor the mind bestowals of the Infinite Spirit, seem to exclude the direct action of the thought adjusters, the indwelling fragments of God in the hearts of his creature children.
Concerning God's presence in a planet, system, constellation, or a universe, the degree of such presence in any creational unit is a measure of the degree of the evolving presence of the Supreme Being. It is determined by the en masse recognition of God and loyalty to him on the part of the vast universe organization, running down to the systems and planets themselves. Therefore, it is sometimes with the hope of conserving and safeguarding these phases of God's precious presence that, when some planets or even systems have plunged far into spiritual darkness, they are, in a certain sense, quarantined or partially isolated from intercourse with the larger units of creation. And all this, as it operates on Urantia, spiritually defensive reaction of the majority of the world to save themselves as far as possible from suffering the isolating consequences of the alienating acts of a headstrong, wicked, and rebellious minority. While the Father parentally encircuits all his sons, all personalities, his influence in them is limited by the remoteness of their origin from the second and the third persons of deity and augmented as their destiny attainment nears such levels. The fact of God's presence in creature minds is determined by whether or not they are indwelt by Father fragments, such as the mystery monitors. But his effective presence is determined by the degree cooperation accorded these indwelling adjusters by the minds of their sojourn. The fluctuations of the Father's presence are not due to the changeableness of God. The Father does not retire in seclusion because he has been slighted. His affections are not alienated because of the creature's wrongdoing. Rather, having been endowed with the power of choice concerning himself, his children, and in the exercise of that choice, directly determine the degree and limitations of the Father's divine influence in their own hearts and souls. The Father has freely bestowed himself upon us without limit and without favor. He is no respecter of persons, planets, systems, or universes. In the sectors of time, he confers differential honor only on the paradise personalities of God, the sevenfold, the coordinate creators of the finite universes. Boy, there is just so much
wow.
there.
Wow. Yeah.
That paragraph 10 is, that's very interesting. I've never really thought about the purpose of a quarantine with that paragraph in mind.
Hmm. With the hope of conserving and safeguarding these phases of God's precious presence. Wow.
Yeah.
It's like they're saying, no, we don't want to be cut off from that. And it's us that we can cut ourselves off, right? Is that what you think, Marvin?
Well, I think that's very valid. There's just a lot that flows from this paragraph. What I was struck by is in the second line where it said the presence of God is determined by the en masse. In the Supreme, by the en masse recognition of God and loyalty to him on the part of the vast universal organization running down to the systems and planets themselves. It's almost like the presence of God in the Supreme Being is a resource, and having accumulated to a certain point in any part of the universe, that's a very, very precious commodity. And with the hope of conserving and safeguarding that accumulated presence of God in the Supreme, and not having not sort of having it destroyed in a sense or put sort of moved backwards dramatically, that there's a cordoning off in order to protect what has been accomplished. That's really interesting.
I'm thinking of Perry's idea of the reservoir again. the reservoir where as a resource, the precious presence. But my point is, because then they go on to explain how. We accept that, and so what would stop this? So the idea of quarantine. What is it about us that needs to be quarantined? Is it this idea? What is toxic? I mean, we understand quarantine, and quarantine happens when something can be catching, and it can spread.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's that disease of self-determination and self-assertion, particularly the idea that I should have the right to assert my will in all circumstances, regardless of outcome and regardless of how that fits with the will of God. And evidently, that is not widespread in other places, or every place would be quarantined and isolated. We can hardly imagine what a normal world is actually functioning like, how much harmony and order obtain on those worlds. Because you hear it all the time. Somebody decides that they're going to do something because somebody told them not to, or I have the right to self-determination regardless of the consequences to other people. And I'm not going to get into anything that could be construed as political or whatever, but all you have to do is look at our society, especially here mm-hmm. in America, and you see all kinds of examples of entitlement in one way or another, and that is on either side of the political spectrum. There isn't entitlement. You know, we have the rights that we have because we confer them on each other. And therefore, there's a responsibility to go with those rights. But we hardly ever mm-hmm. talk about, you know, individual responsibilities or societal responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And if we did,
right.
then we would be closer to being a normal world. But we're far from that.
And being balanced. It's intriguing. Oh, I wanted to say, too, there's some noise in the background again. So if you want to adjust again, Marvin, that would be great. But go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah, I don't think I can adjust anymore.
Okay.
that last sentence is interesting. And all this, writes on Urantia, is a spiritually defensive reaction of the majority of the world to save themselves as far as possible from suffering the isolating consequences of the alienating acts of a headstrong, wicked, and rebellious minority.
Right, alienating.
You know, but the one thing I would add is the picture I get is it has to do with leadership, with the spiritual leadership of the world. And the chaos that's resulted on our world is a result of the rebellion and then also the default, the mistaken ventures of the spiritual leadership of our world, leaving us isolated and alone and without leadership, so that we're wandering, in a sense, in the desert without any real clear parameters as to what's going on in the cosmos, in the universe, mm-hmm. as a planet. And that's a profound danger, is that in other parts of the universe, if that philosophy spread, that the spiritual leadership would be corrupted and default, and they would be similarly left, in a sense, rudderless, you know, without mm-hmm. any real sense of where, what we're part of and where we should be going. And mm-hmm. what struck me about this paragraph is that's a real danger that they take very seriously. And that's the reason for the quarantine, is because there could be much further losses of the gains that have been stored in the Supreme. Anyways, it's interesting. We're going to make our way back, obviously. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, what comes up for me in this is that it gets back to the family model. We do mm-hmm. not have the family model on our planet. If mm-hmm. Adam and Eve had been here, they would have established the family model, and then the Universal Father presence and over control and love. All of that would be a part of what we are experiencing, but we were denied that in the rebellion. So we're trying to, we don't have a family model as in general as the individuals are responsible to. That's why there's too much self-assertion. So that's what's missing. That's what I see, because there's those beautiful structures that hold things together and give purpose and meaning, and it's almost like the rule of law is a family model, you know, ultimately. Go ahead.
What, did you finish your thought?
Yes. Thank you.
I agree, and I have to say that they use that word loyalty, you know?
Mm.
It works mm-hmm. because of loyalty. But part of our problem is we have leaders, but it seems that our leaders have no leaders.
Yeah.
Or it seems to me that our leaders on this planet. You know, it's not that there are no leaders. It's that those the leaders that we've had have been headstrong, wicked, rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so where have we been led? As Jesus said, you know, the blind, when the blind lead the blind, we all fall into the pit.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it even more important for us to understand that God is within us and that we could follow, you know, at least we can learn to follow our heart and be loyal to our highest concepts of truth, beauty, and goodness. Be loyal to that and mm-hmm. loyal enough to live it out and to mirror it for children. We
yes,
simply cannot...
Yes.
expect to say one thing and then do another and think that that's going to be influential on the little ones in our world. They're moved by our loyalties, right? It says it straight up. Example
mm-hmm.
and even precept don't move them like loyalty does. And loyalty means you are willing to live this out. You hold it as truth, then you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's missing. That's what's
yeah.
missing in families. That's what's missing in governments
mm-hmm.
is that strict loyalty to truth and to
mm-hmm.
beauty and to goodness, you know, where we uphold the highest principles as high as we can understand them and not just say them but live them out and
mm-hmm.
mirror them for each other by doing it. Acting out love, you know, and
well,
honor and
yeah, go
respect.
Ahead. Finish.
Well,
yeah.
Well, that's we're down to the last 2 minutes, Marvin. So I'll go ahead and you know say give you the last word. But I just want to share one thing Perry said on the board. She said, "This is the message of Lucifer. I am separate." That's the toxic idea of separation. No God. No connection with God, period, you know?
Right, exactly.
So, but go ahead.
Well, that fits very much with what I was going to share, which is in the vacuum of leadership that results, what we're left with, what we're dependent on is human beings who show forth a connection with the indwelling spirit, which is where the leadership must come from. And it's much more subtle. It's not as overt. But when we see the fruits of that spirit in a person's life, in any realm of leadership, that's what we're responding to, is the truth recognition, that this person is being spirit-led.
Mm-hmm.
And I can trust the values that are being explicated by this person. And it's an imperfect mechanism, but it's the best that we have. And it's what we retain given the isolation we're in. So
right.
It's the best we can go forward with.
And because we don't have an Adam and Eve, more falls on us to try to live it even more than we would have otherwise, probably.
Yes.
We wouldn't have
mm-hmm.
needed
yes.
to be so true to it and so careful about it because we would have had that great example and constant reminder. But now we have to dig deep within ourselves to be that goodness we want to see in the world. And to be that love we want to see. Well, what a great conversation,
yeah.
you guys. Wow. What a
yeah.
what a wonderful paper. I am so looking forward to exploring this one further with you. Next up
yeah.
is God's Infinite Power. I sure enjoyed his everywhereness, though, I got to say. And
that
thank
was good.
You all. Thanks to our listeners. Yeah, I really appreciate this conversation. I needed this. So
yeah.
thank you, everyone.
Yes. Thank
well,
you.
Until
guys,
next
thank
week.
You.
Yeah.
Until next
good
week.
To be with you.
We'll be back. Twist
I'll
our
be
arms.
With you, Pam and
Twist our
Paula
arms.
And
yes.
Marvin.
We
yes.
may all be here.
Thank you. Thank
yeah.
you, dear one.
That would be fun. Yeah.
Here's to a great week, and May Day is around the corner.
May Day.
It is.
May. Beautiful spring. All right, my friends. Well, much love to you.
Yes, love you.
Love you all.
See you soon.
All right.
Bye for
now.
Now.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.